panic. Just literally keep talking about that. Hi, you're listening to Recover Girl. It's a podcast all about addiction and recovery. So excited about my guest sitting here on my couch. I've got Ian Harvey here.
Thanks for having me here.
I'm so excited you're here. Let's do the double backup recorder. And it's interesting because as you were just talking, we were just talking about your friend who does energy work.
Mm-hmm.
And you said to me, she's had all these different lives.
She has. She's had probably 15 different lives.
But what's interesting to me about that is right before that, we were talking about our mutual friend, Amy Dresner.
Yes.
And you said she's had, we both said she's had so many lives.
Yeah. And you had said you only sort of knew one.
Yes.
Or one sort of genre of her life.
But let's talk theme, because it is such a theme of recovery. How many different lives have you had?
I've probably had at least a dozen.
Do you think?
Yeah. Yeah. My early life was dreaming of being an artist, musician, but I was too lazy to practice.
What kind did you want to be?
I played guitar and sang terribly.
Mm-hmm.
And basically like covered songs. I never really wrote any of my own songs. I felt everything's already been written about, so I'll just play other people's songs. And that was just my excuse or my block.
Fear.
From trying to, be creative and write something. And I remember in college, I did get hurt hard enough and deep enough that I wrote one song. And it was because I accidentally burned down my best friend's dorm room by accident. Like, I was smoking cigarettes. I had put the cigarette out in her ashtray in her dorm room. This was when that shit was allowed.
Yeah.
And we went out into Boston, like, shopping for, like, the afternoon. And we came back, and the fire department had surrounded her dorm. And we're like, well, it can't be you, can't be yours, whatever.
Right.
Turned out it was. And I had dumped the ashtray before we left.
Ah.
And so she never spoke to me again.
Everybody knew it was you.
Well, the fire department interviewed everybody that had been in the room.
Did you know when you saw the fire, you're like, this is me?
No, I didn't know. I had no idea.
Okay.
In fact, they interviewed and sort of questioned everybody who had been in that room in the last 24 hours kind of thing. And it was like a big party room, and everybody was smoking in there. Everybody was like doing whatever. But the fire department was like, so was anybody smoking in here? We're like, yes, a bunch of people were, but we always use the ashtray. Like, no one like flicks butts anywhere, you know? And then I said, I think I emptied the ashtray. And basically they were like, all right, it's wrapped up. We got the answer here, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, to my lame defense, there was a giant life-size poster, one of those vertical posters of James Dean in a girls' college dorm.
Yeah.
And there was a wall plug behind the poster, and her roommate had plugged in her like blow dryer through the poster and into the wall.
Yeah.
And it was left that way. So, but the ashtray that I dumped was right by, in the wastebasket, right by that. And so it's like, they said it started over in this corner. It was the hottest over in this corner. They measured those temperatures, whatever. But I just took the blame. I said, it's most likely that, you know?
Yeah.
So I took the blame and I went downstairs after that. And my friend Julie said to me, she's like, what did you say? What did they ask you? And I told her, and she was like, are you fucking kidding me? And I think that was like the last words I ever heard out of her mouth.
Wow.
And so I was so upset that I upset her, because she lost a lot of things, like family photos that she had brought to school with her, personal items that she just can't get back, you know. And her parents were also in the middle of a move from Michigan to Florida, so they mailed her all her shit.
Oh my God.
So all her shit was in her room. Her roommate lost a bunch of stuff too, but her roommate didn't have all her personal items there. And so anyway, I think the last words were like, you're fucking kidding me kind of thing. And then never again. So I wrote my own original song about that whole thing back then. I don't even remember the words to it, but I think I maybe remember the chorus, which was so, trite at the time. But it was something like, burn this deep down. Something about like in reference to the fire. Like, I felt equally as bad as she did losing her things at, for having done it to her.
Yeah.
And being 18 years old, you don't, nobody, like, all I could think about was her and her hurt and how hurt I was that I hurt her. So back to the musician artist thing.
Yeah.
That was like the only probably original song that I, serious one that I ever wrote. I've written jokey ones as a comic, like, and, yeah, you know, stupid stuff, but it's not my genre. So, but I wanted it to be at some point. And so that was probably like my first life was wanting to be an artist musician. And I didn't know that I was meant to be one in another genre.
Right.
But I went on to do other things. I went on to do like, I was a line cook in a deli. I was.
Is this all on the East Coast?
Yeah, all back in Maine.
Okay, so where did you go to school in Boston?
So I went to college in Boston for a year. Mm-hmm. I didn't go back after that.
Wow, yeah.
One, because so my drinking was so heavy at that time, and I didn't know who I was. I didn't know that I was actually in love with my best friend from college. I just thought she was my best friend, you know?
Like, not Julie.
Yes, Julie.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Okay.
So, but I didn't know that's what it was. Like, right. I had all, like, throughout high school and beginning of, and for a little context, I'm trans. So I was born a girl. I was going to a girl's college.
Wellesley?
No, I went to LaSalle.
I don't know that school.
LaSalle in Newton. It's just like a mile from BC.
Yeah.
And kind of like between Wellesley and BC.
Okay.
And in Newton. And I, you know what? Like, I didn't understand who I was. I didn't understand my sexuality or my orientation, my gender, anything. But I knew that there was like something going on for me huge. But I was falling in love with like all of my best girlfriends.
Right.
And through high school, like my, you know, my best girlfriends in high school, same story. And so all of that like fed into my drinking. It's not why I drank,
right?
Of course, but it definitely fed that desire to like squelch out the static and all of that noise that I couldn't figure out what it was. So I didn't go back after that first year, after I burned Julie's room down.
Yeah.
You know, like all of that stuff. I just never sort of recuperated. But I also was uninvited back by the dean if I was going to continue my drinking.
For that?
No, for my drinking.
Oh, okay.
So
okay.
After my first semester, I was invited to the dean's office. Yeah. And she said, listen, if you continue to miss classes, I think I went to maybe two that mm-hmm. first semester. She said, I will personally fucking buy your bus ticket home. And I was like, okay. So second semester, I went to every class, and I left there with maybe a 0.9 GPA because I had gone to no classes the first semester. Second semester, I did average. So bring that down to like something really, a really shitty average. But my drinking was so out of control. I went home. I never went back to college. Julie never spoke to me again. And I went on to try to figure out who I was. And I thought that once I figured out that I was queer, I was like, oh, I'm done. Like, oh yeah, I'm done. I got it. You know, finally could like peel back the layers, understand, but my drinking continued. And I really thought that it would help remedy that whole situation, that things would clear up for me. But the truth is, like, I was obsessed with, you know, booze from the time that I was like 6 or 7 years old, watching adults drink.
Right.
I couldn't wait to get a drink in me. And not because of my gender, not because of my sexuality, but because it just looked amazing to me. And
did your parents drink?
No, no.
Okay. So you were just seeing it in movies or?
Oh, soap operas. I was obsessed with soap operas.
Days of Our Lives.
Yeah, actually, all my children, One Life to Live in General Hospital, all in a row.
Oh, interesting. On Days ABC. Was mine.
Yeah. But they always had a cocktail in their hand,
right? Yeah.
You know, that highball of scotch or whatever, you know, just always like, even like, you know, with their own, like hammering their own ice, you know,
right.
And, you know, like making a cocktail, that doctor who was like, I don't know, just, it just constantly was always on. And I was obsessed with that kind of stuff. So before it ever touched my lips, I couldn't wait for it. So it wasn't until I was about 10 years sober that I realized that, you know, yes, all of these things that were going on in my life and my trying to figure out my sexuality, my gender, my orientation, all that kind of stuff, that whole sexuality umbrella, did I realize that just fueled what was already in me.
Right, right.
Like, it's genetic for me. Like, my 3 out of 4 of my grandparents are alcoholics. It skipped my parents and not to say that they don't have their own isms, but the desire for alcohol, they just don't have that. And they, you know, like even today, like it's so rare to like see even a bottle of wine in their fridge or on the counter. Like it's so rare. It's like, wait, what's happening? Like what event, you know?
Yeah.
It was like, it has to be a big thing.
And you have siblings, you have brothers, is that right?
I have two brothers and a sister. My sister joined our family when we were in high school. So she was my best friend in high school. Yet another one of those ones that I had fallen in love with. But she had a really tough time at home. There was some like bad stuff happening with like stepdad, just what you think, you know. And she came into school one day and said, you know, my stepdad just tried to do something to me. And I said, what the fuck? And I told my parents about it. My parents went to court with her mom and got custody of her.
Was her mom objecting?
No.
Wow. Wow.
So she came to live with us the last couple years of high school. So she's my sister. And
and when your family gets together, she's a part of it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Always. Wow. Yeah. And she's awesome. So she's not genetically my sister. So she's not predisposed genetically to our family's history of alcoholism and addiction. But my two brothers definitely have like their own things going on with it. One of my brothers is in recovery, and the other is not. And but we all have this little thing going on.
Yep.
So.
And so you're obsessing over at 8 or 9. You drank around 12. Is that when?
No, I drank 10? Around 8 or 9.
How'd you do it?
Boys in the neighborhood were stealing booze from their parents.
Yeah.
And the neighborhood consisted of houses surrounding a field on a lake.
This is Maine.
It's out in the middle of nowhere. It's quintessential Stand By Me, Stephen King.
Yeah.
Just like that. Like out in the boonies. It's the 70s. Everybody just thinks that nothing bad can happen.
Right.
So until something bad happens to like you hear how Jimmy, you know, drowned or whatever. But we lived on a pond across the field from us were three families. And one of the families had two really little kids. The other families had kids about our age and older siblings. And their older siblings were stealing booze, putting it in like mason jars, just mixing it all together.
Yeah, and that's disgusting.
And we would go out into the middle of the field, set up tents and like camp for the night kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And when they busted out that stuff, none of the older guys were looking at any of us little ones going, yeah, you should probably skip this for right now.
Right.
There's like, it was humorous to see a little kid drink and get hammered off two sips. You know what I mean? So, but I was set. From then on, it was something that I sought.
Yeah.
So, and it's really upsetting to my mother because she's like, well, where were we? And I'm like, it was the 70s.
It was different then.
It really was.
They just let us run
around. Yeah. 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 So, that was my first, my first experience with drinking and, you know, like, you know, sitting up on like, the two post fence, you know, sitting up on the top rung and, you know, falling over backwards and hitting my head and nobody really thinking anything of it, like passing out. And, so that's really the worst of it that happened back then. But my desire to drink didn't go away. It didn't quiet any of it. It really just accelerated it. And by high school, I was like every weekend. But I had rules. Like I wouldn't go to school drunk or drink at school.
Right. Because that would mean you had a problem.
Because that you'd be a loser if you did that. Right. Yeah. But I just did it every night that I possibly could and every weekend. And my parents went away regularly to do these like really sweet things like called Marriage Encounter Weekend, where they taught other couples how to write love letters to each other. Oh, I know, it's so hippie and sweet. And so they would go away and like teach other couples how to have like sort of rekindle their marriage and not because their marriage was bad, to make a good marriage better kind of thing. And so they would go away from like Friday to Sunday and like we'd have these raging parties.
Yeah.
And my oldest brother tended to be in charge, but he was a little bit a part of what we were doing, but not really as much more the social kind of stuff.
Or is he the one in recovery?
Yeah. And he didn't really have a say anyway because I would just do what I wanted.
Yeah.
So I think his responsibility was to make sure that nobody died. But we would move all the furniture out of my parents' house into the garage and have a band in the living room and, and, you know, like have a massive rager and cars up and down the street. And this is a different location than where I grew up. We had moved. But so it just accelerated from there. Go off to college, just continued into that, you know, massive drinking binge. And then my first trip through recovery was when I was 21. Someone who was a friend of mine in Portland, I was living with a girlfriend at the time in Portland. It's like one of my first sort of girlfriends that I'd moved in with. Mm-hmm. And it was like very exciting time, but my drinking made it very unexciting. Mm-hmm. And I was just wasted all the time. And I had this friend who was sober. I knew she was sober, but I didn't know what that meant. Mm-hmm. You know, sober to me back then was like, oh, like maybe you just don't drink hard stuff, which right. a lot of people identify sober with. No,
yeah.
Sober is you don't drink anything, asshole. They're like, yeah, I don't drink. I mean, I drink beer once in a while. No, that you drink.
Or they think you mean sober right now.
Yeah, right. Sober right.
Too.
Yeah, yeah. That's a good one. Yeah. So this friend of mine, Meg, really saved my life, introducing me to recovery. And she called me one day. I was on what I used to call a third day of my hangover, but it was really alcohol poisoning. And mm-hmm. I, again, not until like 10 years in did I realize that was a thing. Mm-hmm. And so she called me on my third day of this hangover alcohol poisoning. And I, she said, hey, I'm on my way to a meeting right now. Would you want to go with me? And I was like, what? And again, because it takes a long time for the fog to lift. It was probably 5 or maybe even 10 years in again that I really thought for the longest time that she was psychic. Like, mm-hmm. how would she know? How could she possibly know
right.
that I might want to? What would she right. just like randomly call me one day? No, she had watched me as yeah. my friend,
yeah.
you know, for several years in the community struggling. And she just said, hey, you know, would you consider going to a meeting? And I said, yes. And so in that moment, I really thought she was psychic. Mm-hmm. Really, all she needed was eyeballs
yeah.
to know yeah. that I might need a meeting or I might need to get sober. So I went. I had that, you know, that spiritual experience of like hearing someone say, and I don't know if you know this, in Portland, Maine is where the chip club started.
No. What yeah. do you mean the chip club? Where they started giving
yeah.
any chips
yeah.
out?
Yeah. So the chip club started in Portland, Maine.
Who knew that was even a thing?
I know,
the
right?
Chip club. Yeah.
Well, the chip, when you get a white chip, new coming back,
yeah.
you know, 30 days, red chip, whatever. So, yeah. So that started in Maine, in Portland, Maine. But so I'm in this big, giant meeting, and someone got up at the beginning. They did the chips at the beginning. They're like, they said, if you are new or coming back, mm-hmm. we'd like to, we don't want to single you out. We want to welcome you in. So if you would like to come up and get a white chip, and something about that phrasing, I was like, that is so nice.
Yeah.
I am getting up. And my body rose and I walked up to the front. I got a white chip. And it's really weird. I looked around the room on my way back to my seat and I saw so many people that I knew that I didn't know that were sober.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, you are. And I was like, oh, huh. Well, this can't be too bad or too culty or too whatever I had, preconceived ideas. And
Jesus-y.
So I stayed for 2 years, 7 months and 23 days, and I relapsed on a relationship.
Uh-huh.
One night, went back, stayed sober 2 months, went out one night, and then I've been sober 24 and a half years since.
Wow.
So this time, 24.
This time, yeah.
Yeah.
God willing, you'll
yeah.
have 24.
You will see.
What's your sober date?
It's November 26, 1992.
We are the same sign. I am November 19th, 2000.
Oh, really?
Yes. I don't know what that makes
so
us.
So cool. That's very cool.
You know what's interesting that you just said about how you went in and you saw these familiar faces? It's interesting because I feel like there are so many people out there who don't go because they're scared they're going to see people they know. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but you know what? I do know. I totally know what you mean. But for me at that time, I was so desperate that it was actually really comforting.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, I'm not the only one. A
yeah.
few, you know, that was really relieving to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I felt the same way. But it's interesting. People think they're going to get, somebody just said this to me last week. They think they're going to get busted. And I'm like, no. They're there too.
Well, the other side of that is busted because if you go there anonymously and don't stay, then no one, there's no accountability to anybody else's eyes that saw you there.
Yeah.
So if you go there and you know no one, then you can go back out and quietly, you know, but if you see somebody there, you now are sort of visibly accountable to someone that you know,
right,
that you are in this room with them. So there's something about that that, you know, it's not just that you're caught, but it will ruin your drinking after that, seeing someone else that you know, and maybe you don't want that ruined.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'd never thought about it like that. I wonder, I mean, I had a one night, I went out one night and it did ruin that, but I don't know what it's like to kind of have, you know, the head full of AA and the belly full of booze, as they say.
Yeah. No, just, you know what, just on the two nights that I went out over those 2 months, like, so...
Wait. So you were out for 2 months?
So no. Like, I went out one night.
Yeah.
Was sober 2 months, went out one more night.
Oh, I did. Okay. Wow.
And now I've been sober 24 years.
Bad nights. So, those 2 nights.
Yeah. But the 2 nights were 2 months apart.
Yeah.
And, but each time it was even one night.
Yeah.
It was ruined.
Yeah.
I was like, oh,
I know. You just know too much.
I knew exactly what I was doing.
I know.
Yeah. And no excuses. I remember sitting in a, I was upset. I was sitting in a bar. My brother was there. And I ordered a beer and he was standing next to me and he was like, hey, what are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, don't worry. It's cool. I'm better now.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't know. And I was like, I just talked circles around him until he would shut up about it.
Yeah.
And here's the thing, like when people are that committed in their head, it's like no one can stop them.
But also, don't you find, I don't know about you, but I'm an amazing storyteller. Like, for myself, but for other people, I can convince people of almost anything.
Oh, yeah.
I can convince friends that someone's a terrible person.
World's best liars, yes.
But it's just like, I believe it so much that's really like, I can just spin it however I want.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I have that ability, too. Even today, I do.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't go away. I just consider it like, it's now, it's not about, like, I'm not using it now so I can get away with, you know, bullshit. I actually channel it now into, like, creative arts, like lying on stage as a comic, you know,
yeah,
like, or that creative license to exaggerate or talk circles around people or, you know, it's not to do harm now.
Right.
Yeah.
Did you always want to be a comic after this I'm going to be a musician thing faded?
No, it took me a while to get there. I was a web developer, started a web development company. I worked in a publishing company and then back in 1995, 1996, and someone said, hey, this web thing's going to be big, we think. Will you take over the alternative weekly newspaper's website, which I had to learn HTML code.
Mm-hmm.
To do, and I did, and then I was like, I do think this web thing is going to be big, and so I started a web development company in 1996, and I was going out sort of door to door convincing people that the web was going to be big, and people were just like, no, I don't know about this whole, that's crazy, and I still own the company. It's primarily a hosting company now.
Are you a extremely wealthy internet multimillionaire?
I'm not. I'm not. No, I am not.
But you got in at a time that
you would think, but
yeah.
But I'm not a business person.
Right.
I don't. I'm a bad business person. I probably should have at the time started the hosting company in 1996.
Yeah.
I did not start it probably until 2000.
Mm-hmm.
So by then, like all these major,
and
they were like residual income, like monthly income, someone paying you for, you know, that space. And now that space is now called the cloud and people are selling cloud, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
It's so crazy. But that, like, I just didn't think, I wasn't a good business person.
Mm-hmm.
In that regard. Like, basically, I wanted to, like, be creative and design websites. And in order to do that, at the time, I had to start my own business because no one else was doing
mm-hmm.
that. For me to work for somebody else, there weren't any other companies at that time.
Oh, were you still in Maine?
I was.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, fast forward to now, I still own the company. I build sites for friends
mm-hmm.
on the side. But I don't, like, if someone's like, hey, can you, what? Yes. But like, I don't really take, like, new clients, like, off the street kind of thing. It's
right.
only by, I think I've probably done 3 websites in the last 3 years.
Did you do your own? I was just on it.
I did, yeah.
It's a lovely
yeah.
site.
Oh, thanks, yeah. I mean, it's basic, but yeah, it
like
does the
work.
Trick. So, yeah.
And so, okay, and so then you start to say, when do you make your way to LA and all of that?
So I was in my Websmith company, mm-hmm. and I'm sitting at, my mail comes through the mail slot in this this big artist building where I had my offices, and the mail comes in as a postcard, and it was like, hey, learn to write stand-up comedy, comedy workshop at the local comedy club. And I let that postcard sit on my my desk for probably 3 weeks, mm-hmm. 2-3 weeks. And I was interested in it, but I was afraid. And I this is what kind of prompted me to do it, to call the guy. I remembered that when I was a kid, we used to put on shows for our parents and our aunts and uncles, as everybody, mm-hmm. most everybody that I know does. And I would always come out in the intermission and do stand-up and write jokes. And I wrote jokes that were horrible. They made no sense whatsoever. But that was the funny part, too. The adults was like, this is absolutely horrible, but it's funny because it's horrible. And so I remembered that. I would come out and I would also do impressions of other comedians. And the only other comedian that I knew at that time was an impressionist named Richard Little. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know who Rich Little is. Yeah. So Rich Little, I think he's still working in Vegas. But I would do impressions of him doing impressions of Richard Nixon, mm-hmm. like just ridiculous stuff right. in the intermission. So I remembered that about myself. And I was like, you know what? Like, maybe that's something. Maybe, I don't know. Like, I would love to do that. Like, I don't know. So I called the guy. He's like, yeah, I got one spot left. And which is a great sales tool, by the way. Amazing. Yeah. You're like, yes, I want it.
One spot. And I'm not sure if I can give it to
you. Yeah. Right. Right. Better. You're like, I need it. I got to give it to me. Yeah.
Yeah.
So $300. And I did 7 weeks. Eighth week, you do a live performance. But those 7 weeks, you practice joke writing structure. You bring in your own material. You rip and read on stage in front of your classmates. And by the end, you have to have a solid 5 minutes for a graduation show. Mm-hmm. And I did that. And I loved it so much. Best drug I ever did. Mm-hmm. And
I mean, you were sober at this point?
I was. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so... And since then, my rule in sobriety and doing stand-up is I don't cancel gigs. Mm-hmm. I don't not show up and which recovery taught me this is like, you show up if you say you're going to show up. Mm-hmm. And I do have this button in my head that I want to hit the cancellation button all the time. Mm-hmm. I had a thing yesterday. I had an acting class yesterday. Mm-hmm. I wanted to cancel it.
You're teaching it or you're in it?
No, I'm in it.
Okay.
And I'm like, I'm petrified to go.
Yeah.
But once I'm there, I have a friggin' blast.
Right.
But like there's that thing that like, you know, like, so I don't let myself say no to myself mm-hmm. anymore, especially mm-hmm. if I know it's something that I signed up for it.
Yeah,
sought it out.
Yeah.
You know, I'm paying for it. Like, why am I going to self-sabotage in this moment and not go? And there is, I don't know if it's related to like necessarily to my addiction as much as it is to my recovery.
Yeah.
That like it's my, like, listen, you clearly want this for yourself. What is going on with you? I'll tell you, every time before when I was using, when I said no, it was always followed by a million other no's.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning, like, it was a spiral. Like, if I said no to this one up here, then it gave myself permission to slide even further down and further down and say no to everything. And so I never finished anything. I never mm-hmm. accomplished anything. I never got anywhere. I never created anything. And so my rule today is I don't allow myself to push that button.
That's so interesting because it's also, I think, probably applicable in addiction and alcoholism when you say yes. Like, yes, I had a rule that I won't drink during the week, but okay, yes, I will. Or I had a rule, like, it's easier to say yes to the next line that you mm-hmm. thought you'd never cross. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
I just heard a thing on NPR yesterday. This is sort of obvious, but it's some study that like it's the same thing with lying. That like it's once you lie once, it's that much more. It's that much easier to keep doing.
Well, yes can be a spiral down too.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, either word can be a spiral down. But for me, like I just think, okay, like, why do you want this for yourself? Why in the long run? What do you want to get out of it? What very quickly try to just get myself back into the mode of why I wanted it rather than I don't want it.
Right.
Things like that. Like acting scares the bejesus out of me. I don't know what I'm doing, you know, like I've done a few things, but I'm so petrified that I don't know what I'm doing. And then I have to remember that nobody knows what the fuck they're doing.
Yep.
Everybody's faking it. We're improving right now.
Yep.
Everybody's improving.
Yep.
even if you have the lines memorized, you're still improv-ing
right.
what is about to happen. Like, you're trying to capture a moment and the soul of something. So, like, I don't know. Like, what am I afraid of? Everybody's faking it.
Yeah.
Everybody. So, yeah. like, I go to the, that's what I try to access and stop, like, telling myself all the scary stuff and mm-hmm. that, you know, everybody's in the same boat. And I, you know what? That's what I've done with my transness, too. Like,
really?
I think everybody's trans. Like,
you do.
I look around and I just think everybody's struggling with their masculinity, their femininity, their gender every day. And yeah. if they're not, then they're the fucking weirdo, not me.
I read something that you yeah. said about that, even with body.
Yeah.
That's where I related yeah. to it.
I mean, if you, nobody's 100% comfortable with their body.
Yeah.
Nobody is.
Because we're these, like, souls walking around in these flesh suits. Like, but, how could we be?
But if you think about it, you can take whatever weird thought you have about your body and you can draw a line back to that continuum or spectrum or whatever you want to call it about masculinity and femininity and where we are told we're supposed to be
mm-hmm.
and what we bought out of that, those, mm-hmm. that garbage that we're fed, you know, mm-hmm. what part of that crap that did we buy? And so, and it almost indefinitely has to do with masculinity or femininity in some level or, mm-hmm. Or not wanting to be either, you know, of those things. Mm-hmm. Like, so where do we fall in that spectrum in this moment right now? And if you are not in discomfort with some sort of thought about your body, then you're the fucking weirdo because mm-hmm. everybody else that I know is struggling mm-hmm. with something.
Mm-hmm.
So I used to think when I first understood who I was, oh my God, I'm the only one, even though I had trans guy friends, trans lady friends and, or non-conforming friends. And so I thought, oh, then we're the only ones. And I moved to LA mm-hmm. in 2006. Mm-hmm. And I was like, are you shitting me? Everybody here is trans. Like, mm-hmm. everybody is, like, walking around, like, struggling with body stuff, mm-hmm. especially here. I mean, this is a plastic surgery capital of the country. So mm-hmm. I just started aligning myself with people. And it's kind of like my journey into recovery, too. Like, before I stopped drinking, I thought, nobody understands me. Nobody feels the way I do. And so, glug, 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 glug.
Right.
Nobody feels this way. I'm like, the only one. And then I got into recovery and I met all kinds of other people that were also struggling. And I was like, oh, I'm going to stop misaligning myself and look around me and see all the people who are also struggling with this. And I feel the same way about gender. Like, so I stopped thinking that I'm the only one or just the people that I knew were the only ones. And now I just think that everybody has this thing.
And so when did you start transitioning?
I started, like, I've known for probably 16 years
mm-hmm.
But I didn't have the words for it before then until I met my first trans guy. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh my God, that's me. Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God. That's it. That's it. That's the thing that's been nagging. That's the thing. And then, it took me a long time to get to that place of, like, okay, if I do this, will I stroke my mother out?
Mm.
No, actually, I'm not going to mm-hmm. stroke my mother out. But I definitely thought, you know, like, for the first time, I was thinking of others instead mm-hmm. of myself. And that actually, like, I had to work on my own codependency issues
right.
at that point, you know, and go, okay, I could make others uncomfortable and make myself happy, or I could be uncomfortable myself and make others happy. So, did I say that right? I
don't know.
Anyway, yeah, okay. And so I spent 5 years in therapy talking about it. And then I came out to my parents and my friends. I came out to my friends first and then my parents because I needed that support before I told my parents. And then that was probably I'm trying to think of, like, the number. So I've been doing stand-up for 15 years. This is like my mm-hmm. map backwards. So I've been doing stand-up for 15 years. I was Ian on stage when I first got on stage, although I hadn't physically did my sort of medical transformation, like mm-hmm. take hormones and chest surgery. So I didn't do that until about 8 years ago.
Okay.
But I'm fully cooked now, as
yeah.
you can see.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like,
I get it.
You know,
I see
like
it.
I definitely, like, there's sort of no, other than probably my socialization and my spirit, you know, being sort of male and female, and maybe, it's funny, like, I'm definitely pegged as queer,
mm-hmm.
But I'm not pegged as anything other than a guy.
Right.
But there was like kind of like a, for me, I'm looking in your mirror over there. There was like a, there was definitely like an awkward, my own personal awkward phase of like being on stage performing and beginning my transition, taking hormones and looking like a young boy, just sort of like, I don't know, in my own words, and not bad. I'm not using, saying these words and to be degrading to myself, but it was kind of like a weird, awkward, sort of boy, like boy girl with sideburns, having a chest and sideburns and facial hair starting to come in. And so there was definitely like, for me, and I don't say this about anybody else, but it, for me, it felt like an in-between place. Mm-hmm. And then I had chest surgery and, hormones started to take a bigger effect and a full beard came in and, which I love, and
it's actually voice and very all that hard kind of for me to picture you looking like a woman.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, I mean, that's, I'm, you know, it's, that's the thing that people are always sort of amazed by.
Yeah.
And I get that, because it's like, it's not every day that you meet somebody who has had been so visibly different.
Yeah.
I get that. And it's interesting because people are like, think that you sort of become this different person, and you're not. You're the right. same person. You're the same human being you were before.
Right.
You just might be a little bit more comfortable now.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, it's like, it, add that on top of my recovery, like being happy in recovery and actually getting to have the body that I want and that I feel comfortable in. And although, like, I still walk past a mirror and go, what the fuck, you know, like,
oh,
naked,
really?
Out of the shower, naked out of the shower, you know, you're like, what the, you know, like,
is it like waking up from a dream? You're like, huh?
No, but it's just like, oh, right. Yeah. Like that's me. There you are. Because, you know, I do look like a guy, but stripped down, you know, to nothing and just out of the shower, like, you know, there's definitely some things that look different. Like, yeah. I have faint chest surgery scars, like you can't see them that much, but to me it's like I see it, you
yeah.
know, I still see it, but I do think that that's part of that sort of remnant discomfort that everybody has. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's I'm probably 95% better feeling than I was before.
Wow.
Like feeling more authentic, feeling like I look like what I'm supposed to look like, what I always imagined, what I always felt like on the inside. But put that together with recovery and I feel near unstoppable.
And okay. So tell me, so you start to, you were out about everything. You're out about being sober. You're out about trans. You're mm-hmm. and so you're doing comedy. You did this tour with Amy Dresner and
yeah, Felon. Yep.
And then when did Transparent come about?
So,
and how,
I was asked by a friend, his name is Reese Ernst. He's also another trans guy. And he messaged me on Facebook and email and said, hey, we're looking for background actors for this pilot. Would you consider being part of this therapy circle scene, blah, blah, blah. And I said, yeah, sure. So I went, we filmed it over on the west side, and it was Jill Soloway came in and sat down with everybody that was in the therapy circle, being supporting background to Maura doing her monologue. And Jill sat us down and she said, I want you to know that this story is about my parent.
Mm-hmm.
And it's derived from that. Obviously it's not going to be to the letter, but it was inspired by my parent, coming out and telling me that they were trans and genderqueer. And so this is coming from a very real place for me. And I really want to tell this story. And I don't want you to think that I'm just trying to, objectify and, you know, basically just like shared her story with us and her experience with her parent. And so a bunch of people went up to her afterwards, and I just had this moment of like, you know, it just kind of felt like, I don't know, maybe she was being bombarded a little bit on that day. People were very excited about mm-hmm. this show, and nothing, we'd never heard anything like that. So I kind of quietly left, and I didn't know this, but she was following me on Twitter, and so I messaged her on Twitter and just said, thank you, when does the pilot come out, kind of thing. And she said, we're not sure yet exactly, but it will be in the winter, excuse me. And she said, would you be interested in coming into the writer's room? We want to talk to you about something. And this was probably November, late November of 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm. 2000, whatever.
14.
Okay.
So she said, and this was, the pilot had been written. They had filmed the pilot. And I think they were working on storylines and stuff for the season if they got greenlit. So I said, I'm traveling right now. I'm actually going to Germany to screen a film that I did. And she's like, I'm going to Germany. Where are you going to be? So we tried to actually meet in Germany, but we were like four cities apart. She was like on one end and I was on the other. And I just said, I can't take another train. I'm so sorry. Mm-hmm. I had been performing and screening a film and I was just exhausted. So she said, how about when you get back? I said, okay. So I went to the writer's room in January when I got back after the holidays back in LA. Everybody's back at it. And all the writers were there. She was there. Her sister was there. Her sister Faith and all the great writers of Transparent. And so she just, tell us your story. And so I told my story, but I also infused it with some humor and mm-hmm. And some jokes. And then she said at the end, you know, we're writing a storyline about the youngest daughter, Allie Pfefferman, and that she has a love interest of a guy who's trans. And really, I want you to play this guy. And I was like, what? And so at that moment, I said, you know what? Listen, I'm scared. And she said, what are you scared of? I said, I haven't acted in a long time, which I didn't tell her, which she's probably read at some point because I've said it a dozen times or a couple dozen times by now, is that I hadn't acted since the eighth grade. So
a few years.
I was like, you know, I've been a little bit nervous. I haven't acted in a while, like since the eighth grade. And so she said, well, what if I made it safe for you? And I said, I'm interested. Mm-hmm. And she had me do an acting workshop with the whole cast. And then I had a show at the Wiltern with Tig Notaro, Reggie Watts, Zach Galifianakis, and Patton Oswalt. Mm-hmm. I was hosting this show. There was a big benefit.
Amazing, yeah.
And she brought a bunch of the Amazon executives to see me at the show. I did the acting workshop, and then she texted me like the day after the acting workshop. And I didn't get it. I was driving. She calls and she says, did you get my text message? And I said, no, what? And she said, you got the part. And I was like, what? Oh my God. Oh my God. That's so amazing. I got to pull over. I was with my girlfriend and my girlfriend's mother and pulled over. We were on our way to American Idol.
Nice.
to watch for, yeah, her mom to see. And I pulled over. I'm like, I can't even believe this. I can't, mm-hmm, believe this. She said, it's so exciting. I said, I won't let you down. She said, you know what? I won't let you down.
Right, right.
And I was like, what? That is crazy to me. That, to me, I've just never, I don't know if I've heard anything like that in LA before.
Yeah.
And so the experience, if you can imagine her, someone in the biz saying that, the experience on set was exactly the same way. It definitely, you know, from the top down, like she set the tone for that set and what it's like and what it's supposed to be like. And it was just really incredible.
You know, it's interesting. I know Micah.
Oh, yeah.
And he did a Q&A. God, I know. I'm blank. Why am I blank? Anyway, we're all in Reboot. You know, Jill is in it, too. It's this, like, you're not even supposed to talk about it. It's this organization,
okay,
for Choose in,
okay,
LA, San Francisco, New York. And they did a Q&A. They did a Transparent Q&A where they talked about the writer's room. And just how unusual and,
yeah,
unique it is.
Oh yeah, they've done they go away for like a week before the season starts and do a lot of like sort of sweat lodge kind of chanting and like all kinds of different sort of things to sort of access deeper parts of themselves to write in their most authentic self. And then they also do workshops with the actors before the season starts, before they start filming. And so it's a really like unconventional,
yeah,
to what Hollywood is used to. But as you can see, it works really well.
By the way, was Tig already on the show when you did the benefit with her?
I think so, because I think she and Jill are good friends,
yeah,
live in the same neighborhood. And so I think that she was written in as Barb already,
mm-hmm,
I think. Pretty sure.
And so what next? What are you working on now? We got to work towards wrapping it up. So let's get it. Let's tell them everything.
I'm working on a script. I have a writing mentor here in LA that, so Josh Pfefferman, played by Jay Duplass.
Yeah.
Jay Duplass introduced me to one of his writers and called her his secret weapon.
Mm-hmm.
And she's really, really great. Her name's Mir. And Mir has been teaching me. I wrote a script. I gave it to Jay to read. Jay said, I'm going to put you together with Mir. Mir and I have been meeting, and she's teaching me basically writing structure because I don't know what the hell I'm doing. Mm-hmm. So I wrote this script about my life, about my relationships with a lot of like a long sort of list of straight women who thought that they could wrap their head around, you know, me. And so writing about that, screenwriting is just something new that was like, it's one of those things that like, I'm not even telling myself no about that. Like I have no idea what I'm doing, but I just keep trying. Mm-hmm. I like to jump off things and get myself into like a massive hole and like figure my way out. Mm-hmm. So I also run, a summer comedy camp in Maine, for comedy writers. And it started out as a comedy festival for stand-ups. And every year, it's the seventh year this summer, and every year I have extended it by a day and asked the comics to come earlier before they perform, earlier and earlier, and make them do things, literally jumping off cliffs into swimming holes on the side of mountains, zip lining down the side of a mountain.
Is this inspired by how transparent does the writer's room?
No, actually, it was sort of organic. Like I was just planning fun activities for the comics to do. But what I realized that it also inspired them to write. And so the last year that we did it, we made it not mandatory, but loosely sort of, you know, a requirement loosely that you have to write 5 new minutes while you're there. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the week, you perform it in the live shows that we do. So we've been doing that, and I'll be doing that this summer. I also, you know, like I'm actually, you know what? I'm about to, this summer I'm going to do a tour with Lady Parts Justice, which is Liz Wenstead. She was, do you know her? So she was
The writer on
Daily Show. She was like co-creator of the Daily Show. So she has an organization called Lady Parts Justice, and they're doing reproductive rights fundraisers for places like Planned Parenthood, you know, community health centers and places like that all over the country. So I'm going to do a 15-city tour with them this summer. And at all fundraisers and getting people to sign up to vote. And actually, next month, I'm going to, mid-May, I'm going to Texas to do a fundraiser there in Fort Worth. But also, they built a fence around the Planned Parenthood, the community health center there that offers healthcare for women. And there's been a lot of demonstrations there. So they built a fence around it. So I'm going to also help paint the fence. Wow. And help escort people into the center. And I'm just like running around doing whatever. So I have tons of tour dates on my website on ianharvey.com. So live performances, auditioning for shows. It's pilot season, writing, comedy camp, like, anything
so fun.
Anything I can sort of. Oh, and home projects. I just built a deck at home, so Jesus. I'm handy. There's lots of stuff that I do.
Good to know.
So yeah.
I mean, I have some stuff around here that could get fixed. That's not true. Well, and then if people want to find you, you're on Twitter. You're on Facebook. Yeah. All that stuff. Well, I cannot thank you enough for doing this. This has been absolutely a pleasure for
me. Thank you for having me. Thanks.
We're gonna end.